Who should police social media? Twitter reports it's received a record number of government requests to remove content. So is this a way to maintain a safe and open internet for all? Or is it censorship? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the programme. I'm Imran Khan. Most social media firms have made the same promise to provide a free and open platform for users to express themselves. But they're coming under increasing pressure to remove content deemed offensive or illegal. Twitter says it's received a record number of government requests to remove tweets in the first 6 months of last year. Just five countries made 95% of the demands: Japan, Russia, Turkey, India and South Korea. In 54% of cases, Twitter withheld content or asked users to remove posts. But the firm says the request revealed a deeply worrying trend against freedom of expression. The social media giant has had a rocky relationship with some governments. Twitter imposed restrictions and warning labels ahead of the US election in 2020. Users received a prompt pointing them to credible information before they could retweet content labeled as misleading. Following the Capitol Hill riots last year, Twitter permanently banned former US President Donald Trump after he expressed support for the rioters. And in February 2021, India demanded the removal of content, saying it was promoting violence at the height of the farmers' protests against agricultural reform laws. Twitter also deleted hundreds of tweets but refused to deactivate the accounts of media outlets. The Indian government responded by threatening Twitter employees with up to 7 years in jail. Last June, Nigeria suspended the social media firm after it deleted a tweet by President Muhammadu Buhari in which he promised to punish local groups he blamed for violence. Twitter said that violated its policy on abusive behaviour. And 2 weeks ago, Twitter agreed to register in Nigeria and pay local taxes to end the seven-month ban. Let's bring in our guests in London, Quinn McHugh, Executive Director, Article 19, a human rights organisation defending freedom of expression and information. In Maastricht, Viglenza Abezi, Assistant Professor of European Law at Maastricht University and a Fellow at Yale Law School. And also in London, Melody Patry, Advocacy Director, Access Now, a non-profit organisation defending the digital rights of users around the world. Welcome all to the programme. Let's begin in London with Quinn McHugh. Twitter says this is a deeply worrying trend against freedom of expression, but the governments are saying they're just clamping down on illegal activity. Who's right?
thank you very much for having me today. I think the truth lies more on the side of Twitter on this one. We've seen around the world a number of governments who are passing incredibly vague laws that are designed solely with the purpose of allowing them to restrict online content well and above the way that they could restrict content in an offline space or in the regular media. So we've seen an alarming trend of legislation being passed that allows countries to go back to Twitter and say, look, you're in violation of X law, you have to take this content down, which is completely legal and appropriate under international freedom of expression standards.
Melody Patry, also in London, it's an alarming trend that governments are doing. The Indian government threatened Twitter employees with 7 years in jail. We've seen Twitter being forced to pay taxes in Nigeria and register locally there. Is that an attack on the medium generally or just on Twitter?
I think there's an attack on the medium. I mean, you talked about Nigeria. Twitter was banned during 9 months in the country, and when we talk about threats, physical threats, actually, against Twitter employees in India. Google faced similar threats, Google employees in Russia, just a couple of months ago. So we definitely are seeing governments attempt at taking control over the information that is being circulating on the internet and taking lots of different measures, whether they're legislations or other attempts at taking control at all costs.
Viglenza Abezi, the legal side of this seems to be down to either the social media giants policing themselves and having a policy in place that allows them to be the arbiters of what is freedom of speech and what isn't, or governments individually cracking down. Is that a tenable situation?
Yeah, thank you for your question. And while I agree with previous speakers, and indeed we're seeing both vague laws by governments whose interest is more to rather constrain speech more so than potentially legitimate legal interest of lawfulness or, let's say, content against minors or et cetera, other important interests, or the fact that if you look at the data that Twitter has published, specific individuals, specific journalists are sometimes targeted or their accounts are requested to be shut down. At the same time, the reason why this is such a challenging issue of content moderation, and also it's overall a question of how do we regulate these kind of platforms. And what we've seen as someone with expertise both in US and European law, and seeing this from both sides of the pond, the challenge that we continuously see is also the disagreement around what is the primary value that we want to safeguard. Is it really a speech or limiting speech? Are we safeguarding privacy, for example, a concern that's been consistent in the case of the European Union? And oftentimes, obviously, a lot of the governments cannot come to agreement within themselves. So, for example, in the US, too, if we're taking privacy as a matter, there's so many discrepancies between, let's say, what happens in California with what happens in other states, and even so at the global level. And as we've often say in, when we talk about from a legal side of things, that we can't really speak of one internet when we speak of many internet platforms, because there's so many, it's a patchwork and it's a bits and pieces of regulation that is making it difficult. What's increasingly also hard is some of the traditional challenges that we're seeing, whether that's from the side of lobbying in terms of the kind of regulation that should be in place, whether that comes down from lack of consistency in administrations and priorities and understanding the kind of technology that's at stake. So in this sense, we've seen the European Union trying to take some bolder steps, whether that was in the case of content moderation or privacy protections. But indeed, as coming to an overall one global model, I would say that's extremely unlikely, taking into account that so many of the big countries actually have more of an interest to leave things vague and under their discretion, more so than to come to a more global agreement in terms of what kind of rules can we agree across the board, what would be genuinely a content regulation protecting legitimate interests, and what is actually purely an attack on freedom of speech or media or other protections that are legitimate in a democratic society.
Quinn McHugh, in order to protect individuals' rights, in order to protect the freedom of speech, one of the things that has been discussed for a very long time is almost a United Nations Charter of Digital Human Rights, something that actually codifies and suggests that this is what's defendable and this is what is protectable, and given criminal elements, that is something that governments can then deal with. But our guest in Maastricht has said that's going to be incredibly difficult to do. Do you think it's going to be difficult to do? And is it a good idea, frankly?
So it's very interesting to see.
For all the reasons that were just illustrated, it will be incredibly difficult to do. I think one of the things we also shouldn't lose sight of is that under the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, as well as some of these more soft law declarations that have come from the Human Rights Council on the internet, there is a fairly robust structure out there that protects these rights. And these structures do not necessarily discriminate between an offline right and an online right. One of the things we've consistently called for as an organization is that the recognition of the rights that are available to people in an offline standing, whether it comes freedom of the media, freedom of speech, right to privacy, be respected in the online context. That means there's some translation that needs to happen in terms of moving a right from one place to the other, but we wouldn't want to wholesale try and create a new rights framework when actually the rights frameworks that already exist would provide a robust protection for these rights.
Would you agree, Melody Patry, that there are already systems in place that it doesn't need to be codified centrally?
Yeah, I would say that there are lots of protections and lots of safeguards established in international law that do guarantee those rights. Where the challenge comes is in the implementation of these fundamental rights that exist, but also in holding companies accountable. Because as much as governments have an obligation to support and to enforce fundamental rights, companies have somehow escaped have sometimes escaped scrutiny and accountability when it comes to implementing some of the regulations, or even just and enforcing some of our human rights in the digital world. And it's been really difficult to find a comprehensive regulation worldwide, specifically applying to social media companies, for example. But we know that a lot more mechanisms are possible for them to be more transparent, for them to really be accountable, to be more responsive. So there are definitely mechanisms that can be put in place besides what would be like a global regulatory framework. While some of these global regulatory frameworks are necessary, we've seen the success in Europe, for example, of the data protection GDPR, and we can think of other similar initiatives that have been an advance for human rights and for the protection of our human rights online.
Viglenza, often we've looked at social media companies as conglomerates, as businesses, as corporations, which means they've escaped the kind of scrutiny that, say, public broadcasters come under. Like, for example, we have Ofcom in the UK, you have regulatory laws in the US and in the UK that govern what can go on air and what can be printed, etc., because we view them as being corporations. Now, is there a need to change the definition of what a social media company is?
Yeah, so that's a fantastic question, and actually links very well with what I was going to also reply in sense of what already was said, let's say, for the GDPR. So I would just like to take a moment to go back to that point, because while, for example, that particular law was welcome in the sense of its ambition to regulate and to put the interest and the consent of individuals and privacy at the forefront, it still fundamentally does not challenge the business model under which these corporations work. And actually, as many scholars and myself have argued, that is at the heart of the problem. And this links with what you're asking, which is it just a question of design, or is law in itself, in a way, are its tools outdated to actually deal with the kind of problems that the current technologies, the current corporations are presenting? And that's precisely what we're seeing also in the US and to some extent in Europe as well, when we have discussions around using antitrust laws, competition rules to try to break down sort of, if we think of data as the new oil, so to speak, or can we apply those older mechanisms, those traditional legal frameworks that we have, in order to manage it differently? And this is actually where, in a way, the regulators fail, because they're consistently sort of falling back to potentially either not innovative or not bold enough reforms in order to truly create a different playing field. Because I fully agree with what was said. In a sense, it's not about questions of content moderation or specific rights, or do we have enough international instruments at stake? Rather, what the main problem is the lack of understanding that we have right now globally such a mixture between public and private power, in the sense that we're lacking the kind of innovativeness of new accountability instruments and new accountability thinking in order to match the new realities in which we're facing with. And then falling back down to questions of First Amendments, so speech regulation, or issues around constitutional rights and privacy, etc. Those are very traditional frameworks, which are useful and, of course, to be respected. However, I do think right now, we need new efforts. And in this regard, I think a lot of colleagues that I'm seeing across the board are gathering data. There is a different kind of momentum, which is much more promising, that we're seeing in the sense of understanding the nature of the beast better in order to see actually how do we really deal with regulation, because there's the lack of full regulation is not good. Bad regulation is equally not okay, even if there's lack of compliance, because we simply then even further discourage the kind of, and so that has been a little bit the challenge, finding that nuance, finding that right tone with which to regulate this, and considering that it's not a national issue, considering that we're truly talking about, as you said, global corporations, which are based in one country, operate in another, have their data sets stored in another place, their full form, the internet in entire areas of countries, let's say Myanmar that you mentioned before. For a lot of people, Facebook is synonymous, the equivalent to the internet in full. So there's a lot of also discrepancies across the globe in the kind of the playing field, as I mentioned, that we're seeing with between regulators, private actors, and what does that mean for citizens and for the legitimate interests and values that we want to protect.
Quinn McHugh, is there a collusion between the governments and social media companies that actually stops any kind of real regulation from coming into place. After all, if they are corporations, then they get tax benefits, they get freedom to do whatever they want to do to make a profit, and they don't have to have the same laws that, say, public broadcasters do or other media companies do. So is there an advantage for this vagueness for the social media companies and for the governments?
I think one of the things that we all need to remember, as you pointed out, is that at the end of the day, these are profit-making entities who are private corporations, private or publicly traded corporations, who are driven by the bottom line. And as much as they attempt to protect freedom of expression or talk about freedom of expression, at the end of the day, they need to do what they need to do from their own corporate perspective to protect their company, to protect their own staff, and to protect the profits that they make. It was just mentioned about how in a number of countries, the distinction between the internet and Facebook doesn't exist because the only internet is the Facebook internet that people are given access to. That raises questions of, as you pointed out, do they need to be treated the same way that other corporations do? Because corporations have their own interests. And some of the things that we've seen in particular, you mentioned at the beginning of this segment, how India has threatened some of Twitter's staff with arrest for noncompliance with certain Indian regulations or laws. We are increasingly seeing that governments have absolutely no compunction to basically hold staff hostage, to require companies to hold offices, to hold staff in certain locations. We've seen that with Russia, with their landing law that came into effect this year. We've seen it in Turkey with some of the legislation they've passed to try and require companies to house and have offices there. And those are ways of trying to exert pressure on companies. So it's a little bit hard to say that they're in collusion with governments. They're in a space where they're trying to preserve their own best interests. And we should never lose sight of that, that as much as we rely on them sometimes to help us protect rights, they also have their own interests and their own threats. And that will not necessarily always be in line with the protection of human rights.
Melody Pathri, let's just leave alone the corporation and the idea of social media giants just for a second. This also comes down to individuals as well. I'll give you a personal case. Whenever I've flown to the US, certainly in the last couple of years, before the pandemic now, I'm losing track of time here. I've often been asked to give my social media passwords. As an individual going through secondary immigration, there's been no compunction to actually give those over, but the tone is, if you don't, it's going to be very difficult for you to enter. So governments are using this on an individual level. Is that how alarming is that for you?
It is very concerning. And if we put this in the context of increased surveillance online and also the targeting, the illegal targeting of journalists, human rights defenders, human rights lawyers across the world. I mean, in the past few months, there have been a number of revelations about such surveillance practice. So it is alarming indeed, because we are seeing that governments themselves have their own agenda, and that their own agenda sometimes are not legitimate. As much as, yes, disinformation is an issue, it has to be tackled because it is a threat to our democracies. Likewise, incitement to violence online, sexist abuse, racist abuse, and so on. Like, there are issues that need to be addressed. Actually, they need to be addressed offline as well as online. We are also seeing a trend towards control, towards surveillance, towards an erosion of our civic space and towards an erosion of our rights and of our democratic values. And some of that threat has come directly from some governments, and sometimes even from some governments that are not so-called authoritarian or that can push forward some well-intentioned measures. So this is something that we cannot deny. As much as we are facing lots of different challenges and we need to address, and I think in this community, experts are still discussing to find solutions, appropriate solutions to these issues. But we also must recognize that attacks against the media, attacks against the press, surveillance online, targeting of human rights defenders, and an attempt to censor the internet has become a biggest issue in the past few years.
Viglenza, but this is not just about the social media giants. It's not just about governance here, because often Google, Facebook, Instagram, all of their CEOs will turn around and say, actually, we are trying to protect people's freedom of speeches. Leave it to us. We are best placed to be able to do this. But isn't that a bit like putting the fox in charge of the hen house?
Yeah, so I've actually argued exactly what you're just saying, in a sense, in particular for Facebook, because for the longest time, it was self-regulation is the best kind of regulation. And obviously, even Facebook's effort, for example, with its so-called oversight board, which tries to be diverse and sort of have these very, in a way, esteemed individuals who are members of that board. The thing is that I just want to correct something, in the sense that there are some conflicting interests that they have themselves. So what these corporations, in the end, they depend on the trust of their users. They depend on their users liking their products and sort of being able to. So in that sense, if people continuously feel attacked, unsafe, or if it ends up being something that they don't want to use, there's obviously their disincentive on their side and not an interest to actually have. So there is an interest in their side to sort of say, hey, we'd rather have this blamed on the regulator, the fact that we have to shut down your account, rather than say, oh, you have to hate us for doing that, or this is something that we've decided. In a way, it also provides a cover for them, so to speak, that you can sort of blame it, or so to speak, say that it's a question of compliance rather than saying it's a question of them deciding something, because in the end, it gives them that buffer that they can host a variety of individuals, some more freedom of speech oriented, others maybe more privacy oriented, human rights activists or whatnot. The challenge overall here in terms of the regulation, who regulates what and how that should be done, is that there is a question genuinely here of, as I said also before, there is the stake of just the kind of power that they have. And in the end of the day, a corporation can no longer just simply hide behind its corporate veil and say, we're only accountable to our shareholders, when they're actually holding so much public power and so much public influence globally, whether it's elections, whether it's speech, whether it's protests. And so in that sense, it's not sufficient to sort of say that we are able to initially to limit our own powers. But I have to say that there has been a shift in that direction from a lot of companies. And what's disappointing,
I'm really sorry. We are running out of time, but there is a question I want to ask all three of you. Just very quickly, I'll begin with Quinn McHugh. I've had a social media account for over, I think, 12, 13 years now. Why is legislation taken so long? Or even the thought and the talk of legislation?
It's an interesting question. I think initially early on, the global approach to these companies, I think, was led by some of the way they were treated in the United States, which is basically hands off. We want this new technology, this new way of communicating to flourish. We want to treat these companies as just merely intermediaries for the free flow of information. And therefore, we want to protect them as neutral intermediaries from adverse actions because of the content which would be on them, which is inherently speech restricting or rights violating, to punish the intermediary for the content that's hosted.
Sorry, now, we are running out of time. I do want to come to the other guests as well. Viglenza, very quickly, what are your thoughts on that?
My quick tweet, if I may say so, to your question would be that it's actually not true that we're just talking about it now, but I think we're just talking with the level of alarm and urgency and widespread globally more so, because I think many of us have actually expressed concerns. But of course, I agree with the previous speaker that we've also expressed an excitement. But I think it's a fantastic opportune moment to have more public awareness and to hopefully have better tools going forward, both from the legislators and public pressure, to end up having better rules than what we've had now.
Melody, do you have 140 characters you want to share with us?
Of course. And as you mentioned earlier in the conversation, the COVID pandemic has pushed even more people online at a time when we were also seeing some people deprived from internet connections because of internet shutdowns or other issues. And so it's true that it is not a new issue, but there is definitely a lot more attention to the issue. And I think that a lot of legislators are also under pressure because we deserve more, to be honest. Like we deserve more from our legislators, and we also deserve more from the companies and the platform that we use to exercise our rights.
I want to thank all our guests, Quinn McHugh, Viglenza Abbasi and Melody Patry. And I want to thank you two for watching. You can see the programme again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. And you can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is @AJInsideStory. From me, Imran Khan, and the whole team here, bye for now.